You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So we're going to get our hands dirty this hour. We're going to meet a coppersmith's hands, not afraid of open flame or fire. So from cast iron skillets to copper pots to clay baking dishes, we're exploring the methods used to produce cookware and how this skilled trade is deeply rooted and passed down here in Wisconsin. What piece of cookware is a must-have in your kitchen? Do you know how to take care of your cast iron or copper cookware? Do you collect vintage pots? Let's hear about it. 800-642-1234. Sarah Dahman is a coppersmith in Port Washington. Her new book is called Copper, Iron, and Clay, A Smith's Journey. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Well, I just want to get it out there that I cook almost exclusively with cast iron, but it is a love-hate relationship. So I hope by the end of our conversation there's more love. But why are we so opinionated about our cookware?
Cookware is personal on so many levels, I think. You make the choice as a personal choice, first of all, and you have a relationship with your food and your recipes. We have secret recipes, and the cookware is all combined with that. So we kind of treat them like our babies, and we have deep opinions. You know, some people are like, no, cast iron is the best, and other people are like, enameled cast iron is the best. So it's lots of online forums about how to do this best with their cookware.
It's almost like those, you know, cat dog wars a little bit. But, you know, is there something to it that our recipes can come out better if we use the right pot, if we use the right type of, you know, whether it's copper or cast iron or clay?
Yes, there is a reason we've developed these tools and they've stuck around for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And the control you have and the reasons that you're using them vary based on the recipe. And so like the efficacy of your cookware has a lot to do with how easy it is to make a certain recipe. So I would never make a fancy sauce in a cast iron skillet. Sorry, I know you like your cast iron skillet. But I can never do that because I don't have control over the temperature the same way I would in a copper pot.
So we want to nose around your garage workshop. Take us inside of it. This is where you make your craft. What is there?
My garage right now is so full of stuff. It's so bad. My husband's ready to kick me out of my own garage. he's said it's either that or he's going to take over his side with all his woodworking.
Oh, and he so has right his now, side. Okay.
Yeah. Having a war on who can get to the middle of the garage first with all their tools and equipment. I have in the garage a mix of power tools, modern power tools that you would expect to find, you know, in somebody who really likes tools, drill presses and buffing wheels and grinding wheels and big sanders and arborators. Maybe not everybody has an arborator. A buffing wheel and giant air compressors and rivet guns. And that's my kind of my more modern setup. But then I also have a lot of tables that I've attached tools that were made from in the early 1800s and are original tools that are the tin and copper smith rotary hand tools, mm-hmm. the old fashioned smithing anvils and stakes, they're called. They're basically just anvils of all kinds of shapes and sizes and weights. And they're attached to almost any surface I can get them on. And I use those as well. So it's a very dirty garage filled with a lot of copper dust. And it's a very mishmash of modern and vintage that is still totally used every time I go in.
You have burn barrels in there as well because you need flames, right?
Yes, I have burn barrels for seasoning those cast iron skillets, and though we don't do that in the garage because that would be dangerous. And then, of course, I have the tinning setup, you know, for lining the inside of copper pots with melted tin. I have a fire setup for that too, different kind of fire.
We're talking with Wisconsin native Sarah Dahman, one of the only female coppersmiths, by the way, here working in the U.S. She's the designer and founder of a kitchenware and copper cookware line. You can call in with your questions. Are you cooking more at home lately? What cookware have you been using the most? Is it copper or cast iron? What kind of condition is it in? And how do you want to know about how to care for it? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Sarah, how are you getting this work done during the pandemic? What is it like for you?
It is. It's called Kids Don't Go in the Garage. Mommy's in front of her buffing wheel and won't hear you. You know, it's a balancing act because I do have three young kids, ages 9, 7, and 5. So homeschooling them on top of the coppersmith work and the writing is a constant juggle. Might stay up a little later than I should most nights to try and get it done. But it's fine. And I'm happy that I'm able to work so close to home in the garage. So that does take a little bit of a stress off that I can still get my hands on the copper. I'm a little worried about supply chain, just a tad. I still get, you know, all the supplies that I need from the U.S. I don't have to order anything from overseas, so that helps. But, you know, the supply chain of can I get copper sheet or can't I is a little unnerving
if I think about it. Your copper comes from Houston, is that right? And then spun in Ohio?
For the house copper line, that's correct. The smelters are in Houston. So they're the ones who, if I say I want 3 millimeters thick of copper and I want it, you know, deoxidized with phosphorus and I want, you know, CDA 122, you know, if I give them all my specs, they can smelt to those specs and then that's sent to Ohio and then we have the blanks. Each copper pot starts as like a flat piece of copper. And just like any piece of copper you've ever found, it started as a flat piece of copper. And then we water cut it and then raise the bodies up on a CNC machine down in Ohio. And they were the only people who said, sure, we don't know what we're doing, but we will certainly try and figure out how to spin copper. And then they send the blanks to me. And after that, they sit here at the house until I build the entire rest of the cookware.
How do like the handles come on and how do you make those?
The handles, it depends. Sometimes I custom make the handles if someone has a specific request. And so then I fire up, you know, a blacksmith forge and do those. But the rest of the time they're designed based again on specs. And then there's a tool and die maker here in close to Kaukauna, Wisconsin. And, Mike makes the plates, the cope and drag plates that are used for pouring iron. And then those get sent out to a small company actually in, California. I tried to convince, the guys at Rolla Foundry in Kaukauna to pour ductile iron for me. That's what I needed. And they looked at me like I was like, do you know what goes into that? That's a whole nother furnace charge. That's a whole nother crew of people. So I send them off. But it's another small family-owned and operated company. Actually, one of the first companies that had a woman in charge of the iron foundry out there in Lodi. And they pour ductile handles for me. And then they just send them back. And I'm like, okay. So off to the grinding wheel and the sander and the arborator and walnut shells and the sandblaster. And then I have to drill everything out and pull out the rivet gun and start riveting on handles. And a lot of tools happen.
What a production. Amazing. You're talking with coppersmith Sarah Dahman this hour. Her new book is called Copper, Iron, and Clay. Copper cookware heats and cools rapidly and evenly. So what do you want to know about how pans are made and how they conduct heat? What kind of pan cooks the most evenly for you? Are you all about cast iron or stainless steel or copper? Bring it on, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment with Sarah Dahman here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're on a coppersmith cookware journey this hour. You know cast iron for its ability to retain heat. It's the workhorse of the kitchen, they say. I always warn my kids, stop, the handle is so hot. Copper, resistant to rust, the ability to heat evenly, not to be outdone by clay pots, the oldest cooking material known, and still super versatile for our variety of dishes. So what questions do you have about your cookware? Are you curious if it should be replaced or if you're using it right? Are you curing your cast iron skillet correctly? Bring it on, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Dahman creates tin, iron, and copper cookware in her Port Washington garage and outside her garage, and her new book is on the coppersmith trade. So, Sarah, I want to ask you a little bit of a personal question, if you will go there. You started making cookware after a journey of trying to have a child, and you were that kind of was able to wend your way into the kitchen. What could you tell us about miscarriage?
Oh, wow. I totally did not expect you to go there. Miscarriage is mentally harder than I think most people realize, and especially if you have more than one. And it lowers your morale and makes you think you can't do it, like you failed yourself. And it's a really hard place to kind of crawl out of. I certainly don't recommend it if you don't have to have a miscarriage. And I was very lucky that I was able to find something to, in a way, distract me when I was dealing with my miscarriages. And I feel, you know, but at the same time, I don't know how much we can get into how it was meant. But I always prayed. I said, God, you know, I know my temperament. I don't know if I would ever be a good parent to a child who has special needs. I don't trust myself to be a good mother. And in a way, every time I lost a child, I know usually that happens because something's wrong, you know, medically speaking. And I at first used to be really upset about it. And then one day I realized like that was an answer to my prayer. That was God saying, okay, I heard you. I'll call this child home early so that, you know, I'm answering your prayer. So that helped kind of keep it in perspective for me too, once I had that epiphany. I don't know. That got real deep real fast.
No. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
How did you find your way into making cookware?
It was a very organic journey and certainly not planned. I think a lot of good things, if we keep ourselves open, can happen that way. Now I'm going to stay in this philosophical vein. No, I'll get out. And I was researching for my historical fiction books. And one of the things I realized was so much of what was happening in my books and so much of what happened back in the 1800s happened in the kitchen. And of course, then I had to research what kind of things would be in a pioneer kitchen in the Midwest. And I realized that so much of the cookware that we had, our grandparents had, you know, those cast iron skillets that a lot of us have inherited, and the copper pots and the big, you know, thick stoneware bowls. You know, I always imagine, you know, grandma making those big, huge batches of cookies in those big, thick, you know, clay bowls. You know, all of that had kind of disappeared. And if we wanted it, we certainly weren't going to be able to walk down the street to the local blacksmith or tinsmith or coppersmith and pick something up. And I called my husband and said, you know, I really want to start an American-made cookware line. And he's so, we've been together almost 20 years. And he's like, okay.
Go for it.
And so I did. I just started to make calls. And originally the plan was for everybody to make it for me. And I would just sell it. I'd be the marketer. That was what I knew. I was a, you know, marketing, you know, that was my degree, was communications from Marquette. And I was like, let's go down the rabbit hole a little further. Now that I have this cookware line in the works, I should really see how it was made in the 1800s when my books take place. And I happened to stumble upon Bob Bartlemy in West Bend of Beckwith's Tin and Copper, and he's a master tinsmith, and he's 15 minutes from my house. And I said, can I come and watch how you make things so I can research hands-on? And he let me come over. I said, this is amazing. He said, next time you should come back and you should make your own cup. And I said, okay.
I can see where this is going.
And then as I finished that, he's like, next time you should make something out of copper. I was like, definitely want to do that. That's what I really want to learn. And then suddenly I had fallen into showing up at his shop once, twice a week. And that has now been going on for 4 years. And my kids call him and his wife, grandpa and grandma. And it's a very kind of the way it was back when you were a full-time apprentice. You kind of got tucked into the family you were apprenticing under. And so halfway through that, I said, Bob, why am I paying people to make my cookware? I think I can make a lot of my cookware myself, especially the copper. And he's like, oh, sure you can. So we went down to Harbor Freight in Milwaukee and picked up a whole bunch of tools, and I started to fill that garage.
How has he made you better at your craft?
He's made me more patient, which is a virtue I was born without. He has taught me things. You know, I always used to say I'm bad at math. I still think I'm bad at math. But he's taught me how to really tap into being more mechanical thinking. Things that used to feel completely out of my grasp, you know, how to sew clothes without a pattern or even with a pattern. And now that I make cookware, I'm like, oh yeah, the seams, it just the same. I see it. I get it. And he's taught me how to make jigs. I always assume people, you know, the things that you can make multiples of something and out of, you know, steel, and how to use jigsaws. And it's amazing. If you just let yourself be humbled to, you know, say, I know nothing, teach me everything, and become a sponge just like a child, a whole new world can open up.
We're talking with Sarah Dahman. She is a coppersmith in Port Washington, and she's explaining her craft and her trade. She has a new book out. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Sandra now, joining us from Mount Pleasant. Hi, Sandra.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have, it's probably a 16 to 18 inch, one ton pan with a lid that my mother-in-law left, but a skillet, iron, but it is rusty. Is that done for? Is it salvageable?
Absolutely. And hi, Sandra.
Really?
It's nice to meet you. Yes. Yes, no, it truly is. And that's the beauty of a lot of this heirloom cookware, is it's salvageable unless you shatter that pottery pot and don't want to glue it back together again. It's all very salvageable. If it's rusty, all you have to do, you can do one of two things. It depends on what you have available. You can build a big bonfire in your backyard. Doesn't have to be in a burn barrel. It can be just, you know, regular bonfire, and stick it in there and get it real hot, and that rust will start to fall off. And you can do the same thing in your kitchen, but it'll get pretty dirty and smoky. And I highly recommend, if you have to do it in your oven, you know, rev your oven up to 500 degrees and stick it in there. It'll take longer than the fire, and it'll smoke your house a little bit. So certainly open up every window you can. And then once that rust has fallen off, which it will with that heat, you can start to re-season it with whatever seasoning you want and just start putting on a layer, stick it back in the fire for half an hour to an hour, take it out, put another layer on, and just do that a couple of times, and it'll be totally fixable and usable.
Sarah, what do you like to season your pan with?
I use flaxseed oil that I get. You can get it from Wisconsin. Somebody does it here, and I can't think of who does. I usually actually get mine from North Dakota. I keep it as Midwest as I can. Flaxseed oil gives you a very smooth, shiny couple of coats.
How long do you leave it in your oven when you cure it?
About an hour each coat. The falling off of the rust will take as long as it takes, because I guess, you know, cookware doctor here, I don't know how thick the rust is, so the thicker and more it is and the longer it's been on there, the the longer it will take for it to kind of clean up. If you want to speed up the process, you can dunk it in vinegar, and that'll gently remove it as well. So you could always do that. You could dunk it in vinegar for an hour and then dry it off and then stick it in the oven as well at 500 for an hour or two and see how that rust falls off. There's lots of tricks.
Yeah, what does that vinegar do to it?
It just starts to eat at the rust.
Eating at the rust, making it more rapid.
Yes. Yeah, it'll speed up that stripping process.
We're talking about crafting cookware. Sarah Dahman is our guide. She's a Wisconsin-based coppersmith, and her new book is called Copper, Iron, and Clay, A Smith's Journey. So do you collect cookware? Do you have it on display in your home, or do you use it in the kitchen? Where have you found some of your pieces? Share your collection with us at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue this conversation with Sarah Dahman right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A quick mention here that WPR is working to bring you coverage of the latest developments on the pandemic with our reporters around the state. We've centralized our news and analysis on the coronavirus pandemic. It's all at WPR.org/COVID. So right now, we're spending the hour with a cookware coppersmith. We're exploring the history of copper and iron cookware and pottery and the science that goes into making our kitchen pots and pans. Do you struggle to clean your cookware? What do you want to know about caring for it? Did you inherit heirloom pots? Join in, 800-642-1234. Sarah Dahman manufactures pure metal kitchenware in tin, copper, and iron in her Wisconsin garage. We're learning all about it, and she stays with us. Let's take a call now. Fran is joining us from Caledonia. Hi, Fran.
Hi. And thank you for this program. It's very interesting finding out how your guest got into making her copper cookware. I love that story. But I have a very large copper pot, probably a foot across. It's a bowl, really, with handles. It's an antique. I know that it came from Connecticut. And the bottom is kind of crinkly, and it has little small cracks. And I'm wondering, one, if your guest knows what it would have been used for, and secondly, if she thinks it's repairable, if the bottom could be repaired.
Sarah, what do you think?
Hi, Fran. It's definitely possible to repair those cracks. That's the beauty of copper is everything can kind of be brazed and reheated and annealed. And so usually, yes, I say, 99% of the time, those cracks can be brazed shut and any of the damage done to the bottom, which is pretty commonplace for any type of damage, because back in the day, they used to run those pots back and forth on iron grates, and so that's where a lot of wear and tear was. And so, yeah, it's totally fixable. Hard to know what it was used for if it has handles on both sides, if that's what I understand correctly.
Right.
Yeah, then
it's rounded on the bottom. It doesn't have a flat bottom. The whole thing is like bowl-shaped.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I have seen those, but smaller. It either was used almost like a double boiler type thing, or it was used for sweets. I don't know if it's lined or not, but it could have been, almost like a jam pan. And otherwise, it's rounded out because it's bowed out over time. And then it sounds like more of a rondeau, which is a pretty classic shape that goes back to the early or late 1700s, I think.
Well, Fran, so it sounds like it can be salvaged. Hang on to it. And thanks so much for calling. Let's go to Brett now in La Crosse. Hi, Brett.
Good morning, Kate. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about my cast iron. Anytime somebody talks about cast iron, my wife and I get pretty excited. We cook almost exclusively with cast iron these days, a little bit of stainless steel, so now the the copper discussion today has really raised my interest. I just wondered if your guest would talk about an E-tank or electrolysis tank a little bit. It's not anything I've done yet, but that's basically because the fire has worked so well for salvaging old cast iron for us.
I guess I am sorry, Brett, I didn't catch the beginning part of that question. What part of the process?
Electrolysis for restoring old cast iron?
Yes. You know, I don't personally do that because I like to do the old school methods. However, my husband's coworker does it. He rigged it up and he said it works amazing. I've heard great things about it, but you certainly have to kind of know what you're doing. But it really does restore very quickly, and you're not dealing with scrubbing rust off. It pulls those iron oxide particles off very well, but then you definitely have to dive right in pretty quick to start seasoning again and dry that off, and get it. You're still going to have to get that iron hot afterwards to pull any moisture out of, you know, minuscule particles of moisture, and then start the seasoning process. But I can tell you from someone I know personally who's done it, and they really swear by it, and they're the avid cast iron collectors and users as well.
Brett, thanks so much for the call. Sarah, what would you recommend after we've cooked in our cast iron? Say those eggs that are super sticky, hard to get off. How do we clean our cast iron?
You know, this isn't going to be a thing. Like, we're going to get 1,000 calls inside of the other. You can use a tiny bit of gentle soap, like Dawn, on your cast iron cookware if you really need to. And I get that straight from my uncle, who was a blacksmith for decades before he passed about a year ago, and he's a Wisconsinite. So, but he said you can use a little soap. It's fine as long as it's not an abrasive soap if you need to. But if not, you certainly can bypass the soap. But just really hot water to clean all the food debris. And if you have, you know, certainly don't soak it, but get in there with some hot water and a mild, you know, softer scrubby and work on that food, and then go through the, you know, if you do one of two things after that, if you want, you can either put it back in the oven or on the stove and kind of warm it up and pull off moisture, and then you can be done, or you can put a coat of seasoning on, or you can just dry it really good and use it right away the next day. So it becomes a you know, a little bit of a gut thing. And that's the fun of the cookware process and using it, is what feels right for you with your cookware, and know that you can't really wreck it. Make the bad choice. It still can be salvageable.
It can be salvaged. Well, now I don't feel so bad, but when I put a drop of soap on it right when my spouse leaves the kitchen, and I'm like, I got to clean. I don't know how that happened. Let's go to Vicki now in Lodi. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
I just have a quick question about some beautiful copperware that my mother gave me. It's very heavy. It has a tin lining. I didn't use it much until I purchased a nice and heavier gas stove. And now I always just use either cast iron or copper. But what I did notice is I made a really nice squash and apple curry soup. And I noticed that inside of that lining turned almost black, like the next morning after I cooked it and I put it in the fridge. And I thought, wow, I'm not sure if the acid from the apples did that, or if there's things that I shouldn't be cooking in this cookware.
Oh, you know what? Hi, Vicki. This is Sarah. You know, that is a thing. You should not store food in tin-lined copper. So if you cooked in it and then put it in the fridge, because even though tin is inert and it does not like interact with our food when we're cooking in it, it is a very, very soft metal. And so any food, even tap water with the minerals of tap water, if you leave that sitting there for a week or two or three, you will notice a discoloration. And the same goes for food. So if you were storing the food in it, it will cause that discoloration. and it's normal, like, and it's kind of one of those tin line copper rules that you sort of find out by trial and error if no one is there to tell you. So don't feel bad about that. But, and it can always be restored if you don't like it. But yes, it's just don't store it, cook in it, and then always take it out and put it in a, you know, in a store, put it in pottery or put it in a storage container.
I did get it out with baking soda. I scrubbed on it with baking soda and it did come out. But,
good. Yeah.
So it's not that I can't cook acidic foods in it, just don't store it.
Yes, correct. You got it.
Okay.
Sarah, do you ever, thank you so much, Vicki, for calling in. Sarah, do you ever recommend, like, making your copper pots shinier with a bit of lemon juice or letting those tomatoes from that spaghetti sauce sit in there?
Well, if you want to clean the outside, I mean, I definitely don't recommend, especially if it's tin line, letting, you know, food sitting in the inside. But for the outside, any number of things work in it. Again, it comes down to one of two things: preference and, weirdly enough, how old your copper is and where it was made. Because if it's an older piece, it's made with less pure copper, it's going to react differently than a brand new thinner piece of copper from Portugal versus a thick new piece from France versus, you know, so there's a little trial and error on that. But you can use potatoes. You can use ketchup to clean the outside. You can use it, certainly lemon. Sometimes people are like, oh, lemon and salt. Well, make sure it's not a very abrasive salt, because you will see scratch marks just from tiny salt particles. So I've also heard, you know, vinegar work, and vinegar does work. Vinegar, lemon and salt. Like, there's so many cool combinations out there if you want to go the more natural route and not use a copper cleaner, a chemical copper cleaner. Bob, the master tinsmith, one time we were at a rendezvous and he's like, you know, I think rhubarb can clean copper, because one time I was using rhubarb and it made my copper out here real shiny. And so then I started to experiment with it, and it's true.
Well, you just never know. There is so much chemistry to learn here, so much science to learn. What about the Moscow Mule, this drink? It's vodka, ginger beer, and lime juice, and you serve it in a copper mug?
Yes, though I will, I'm going to burst a lot of bubbles. Probably if you had one in a bar, you probably were not drinking it out of a real copper cup. Most restaurants, and I only know that because I make copper cups, and I was, you know, I'd talk to restaurant, you know, owners and bartenders when I'd go out, and back when they were open, and back in the day when bars were open in Wisconsin. You know, they would be like, that's nice that you make them, but we can't buy real copper cups. They're too expensive to buy in bulk, and also people walk off with them. And so we really can't invest. We just have to get the cheap aluminum stamped, you know, painted copper paint on the outside, fake copper mugs. So that's just a
little side note there. Yeah. Sarah Dahman is joining us this hour as we explore cookware and how to make it. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Sarah Dahman here, a Wisconsin coppersmith. Her new book is filled with photos. It's gorgeous. It's called Copper, Iron, and Clay, A Smith's Journey. Let's go back to the phones now. Mark is joining us from Boulder this morning. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Just a side note. Many years ago, my wife divorced me, or she left me temporarily that way. And she took all the cookware, figuring she'd fix me by not having, I couldn't cook anything.
Oh, no.
Frying pan on the wall. And so I made eggs in the copper frying pan. It wasn't tin lined. And I had a very fast reaction. And the doctor said I had copper sulfide cyanide poisoning. I had to drink hydrogen peroxide to expel the contents of my stomach, otherwise I would have died. And as you cannot cook eggs in raw copper. It must be tin-lined.
Wow, Mark, thank you for sharing that story. What do we know there about, you know, when it can be poisonous?
Well, honestly, and you have to have lining in your cookware. You certainly cannot cook in anything in any copper unless it is lined with tin or with stainless steel. They used to line it with nickel as well, but you know, like Mark's story, a lot of people do have nickel allergies or sensitivities, so they stopped doing that a while ago. You can also line copper with silver, though that's very expensive. And so you always need to see that kind of lining if you're going to cook in it. If you're going to raise that temperature up, pretty high and make eggs or, you know, make lasagna in the oven, you definitely want a lining that will transfer the heat from the copper exterior, but protect your food. And that's why, you know, I mentioned earlier, tin is inert. It doesn't react with the food. It keeps it food safe, but you're still getting the efficacy of the copper. So there's a perfect story. And actually, I've never actually spoken to anyone who's had copper poisoning before, but it is a very real thing. And that's why I stand over a fire and wipe that tin in for people like Mark, for everybody. Yeah.
Well, Sarah, your book also has some recipes. And before we have to leave, I want to, you know, be able to talk about one of them, which apparently you like salty cheeses, the halloumi. Is that one of your favorites to make in your cookware?
Yes, it's halloumi is a Cyprian sheep's milk cheese, which you can get here in Wisconsin, though I'd love to have people make it around here. So it's less difficult to find, but it's basically like a slightly saltier version of cheese curds. And I slice it up because it's a very firm it's a very firm cheese, but it's not hard cheese, and it keeps its shape when you slice it. And then I fry it up in a cast iron skillet with a little bit of seeds, whatever seeds and stuff I have on hand, like sesame seeds and hemp seeds, and get it all brown and crispy on both sides. You can totally do this on a grill mat, on a grill. We've discovered that even you can grill this cheese, and it's amazing. It's amazing. It's addicting. You could eat the entire block.
Oh, and so you're doing that in the iron skillet. Is that right?
Yep. Anything with that kind of high temp, because you're frying and you're getting something real, you know, real brown. And also you want to, and you're not covering the whole surface and you're just putting little pieces of cheese on that bottom. That's not what you want to do in especially in tin lined copper. It'll get too hot and you're not covering enough of the surface of the tin. And I really don't recommend when you're doing high temperatures like that, you know, when you're frying, when you're stir frying, anything like that. You really want to do that in cast iron.
We only have a few seconds left, but what should we be thinking about the next time we select a pan to put on the stove?
I think you should ask yourself, what am I cooking on and why am I using it and where is it from? Because we ask that of our food these days, and we should ask it of our cookware too. And in a time when that's part, you know, the food is such a conversation piece, cookware should be part of that, I believe.
Sarah, Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate. It's been so much fun to talk to you and everybody else. It's like cookware doctor moments.
I agree. Sarah Dahman lives in Wisconsin, the author of Copper, Iron, and Clay, A Smith's Journey. And if you'd like to learn how to make two of Sarah's favorite recipes we mentioned here, we have it at WPR.org/mornings. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's a story exploring the history of socialism in the Upper Midwest.
Wisconsin has a rich history and politics that has influenced many of the nation's major political movements. Here's contributor Eric Dregney with a look at Wisconsin's connection to socialism.
I grew up hearing how dangerous socialists were. After all, the Cold War against the USSR could turn hot if we didn't root out the communists in our midst, as Joe McCarthy warned. Then, I lived in a socialist Norway, and my wife gave birth to our first baby there. Norwegian Healthcare covered the birth and gave us $5,000 to help raise the baby and would deposit $150 into our bank account every month until our son was 18. This democratic socialist government paid for my year of college in Trondheim, paid our healthcare, and would pay our pension if we had stayed. These socialists certainly didn't seem so dicey after all. They seemed positively civil. Some American politicians invoke Scandinavian socialism as a model for the U.S., but I suggest we look to Wisconsin. Our state has a long history of alternatives to for-profit corporations in the form of owner-operated cooperatives and profit-sharing credit unions. Milwaukee even elected three socialist mayors. German visionaries in Milwaukee dreamed of a cooperative commonwealth rather than cutthroat capitalism and succeeded in electing socialist mayors that served most of the period between 1910 and 1960. Milwaukee's socialist mayor, Emil Seidel, even lured Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Carl Sandburg to work for him. Wisconsin may have had its share of socialist mayors, but the most influential progressive was likely Thorstein Veblen, born in Cato, Wisconsin, as the son of Norwegian immigrants. He viciously criticized cutthroat American capitalism with his famous warnings of conspicuous consumption. And his book, The Theory of the Leisure Class, became the impetus for the Roosevelt Revitalization Package for the U.S., better known as the socialist-leaning New Deal. Baptist minister Lars Jorgensen Hauge witnessed a poor Danish-American woman break down in tears after she was given just 5 cents a pound for her sweet cream butter, and then only in trade at the company store. Hauge remembered the cooperative creameries back in Denmark. So he traveled the Midwest preaching his butter sermons, pushing the farmers to share their wealth with each other by forming cooperatives. The cooperative ideal spread throughout the Midwest and expanded to general stores, food markets, gas and electrical operations, agricultural elevators, and banks as credit unions. These co-ops offer an alternative system that allows all members to have a stake in the greater good rather than working just for the wealthy. Even Midwestern houses, cozy bungalows, came from the populist arts and crafts movement that took its socialist views and applied them to handcrafted houses that were affordable to everyone. Danish landscape architect Jens Jensen brought his progressive ideals to Wisconsin. He died in Ellison Bay when he worked with Frank Lloyd Wright. Gustav Stickley from Osceola, Wisconsin, expanded on the style with his Craftsman magazine that promoted arts and crafts design and socialist equality. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel wrote in 2010 that the socialists delivered, and the public came to expect administrations rooted in honesty, efficiency, frugality, and concern for the working person. They called their fellow citizens to a higher conception of the common good, one that placed cooperation above bare self-interest. This socialist legacy survives here in the upper Midwest with by far the most co-ops of any other area of the country. Apparently, the democratic socialism that we experienced in Norway was here all along.
Eric Dregney teaches English at Concordia University in St. Paul. He's the author of several books, including Vikings in the Attic, In Search of Nordic America. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.